everybody. Welcome to this week's edition of Two Chairs and a Microphone. I'm Paul Mercurio. Before we get to this week's guest, I just want to let you guys know, October 28th, 29th, and 30th, this coming weekend, I'm going to be at the Improv in West Palm Beach, Florida. That's October 28th, 29th, 30th. A weekend leading into Halloween, West Palm Beach Improv. You can get tickets at palmbeachimprov.com. It's always fun down there, a beautiful venue. Come hang out. We got five shows, two Friday, two Saturday, one Sunday. And this week's guest, Stone Cold Steve Austin. This interview is one of the most surprising and special interviews because I learned so much about something that I knew nothing about, professional wrestling. And you might say, oh, well, I don't really follow professional wrestling. This is exactly why you want to listen to this. It's a fascinating look into what these people do to become stars in that profession, how creative they have to be, how hard they work. A lot of thought goes into it. It may not look it. It's a really interesting conversation that opens your eyes to something, which is the whole reason I do this podcast, which is to kind of talk to people about things that they do that I know nothing about. So enjoy it and hope to see you this weekend, October 28th, 29th, and 30th, West Palm Beach Improv. I'm very, very excited to welcome to the podcast Stone Cold Steve Austin. I got to be honest with you, I never think I'd ever be talking to you. Welcome, man. Thanks for doing this.
Man, it's glad to be talking to a human being face to face. I know we're going to get to a lot of things and you're interviewing me, but that being said, I know you've been in the podcast business a little bit longer than I have.
Yeah.
And most of my interviews have been over the phone.
Yeah.
And it's not like I'm the most skilled interviewer in the world. So sometimes when you're just talking to a cat on the phone, it's just a little bit more difficult when you don't have that eye-to-eye contact.
It is.
So we're hanging out in your room here in Los Angeles. So I'm glad to be here and thanks for having me on the show.
Well, no, I think you are a great conversation. So we talked yesterday before we did this and it was like we knew each other forever. I was like, I hung up the phone and called my wife. I said, I just spent like a half hour talking to Stone Cold Steve Austin, and it was awesome. She goes, what was he like? I go, well, you talk a lot like a buddy of mine, Doug, who's from the South. I know you're from Texas originally, but like, you talk a lot like I said. He sounds just like Doug Richards, and who's a good friend of ours, lives in Kentucky. And we were just talking about all sorts of stuff. So, but I don't think it's anything to do with you and your ability. When I interview somebody on the phone, it's a lot harder because we were talking, like, you don't know when that person's going to, you know, stop or take a beat or, like, you call them a freight. You got interviewed somebody who's like a freight train, right?
Oh, you know, yeah, they're just trying to get a word in edgewise. You know, you ask a simple question and they want to do, you know, do three chapters on it. And I'm like, well, hey, man, you know, I'm trying to hold this thing in about 60 minutes and you're going to talk for 20 about this one single thing I asked you. So you got to kind of, you know, reel them in, cut them off, get them in a different direction. But I love talking to people.
Yeah.
But for me, sometimes I find when I'm trying to interview someone, it turns into a little bit more work than just a conversation. Because like you said, we were talking yesterday. I was sitting in my Ford Bronco in front of my house. I just come in from doing something. And so I called you, and then my wife, because I have this loud Bronco with this exhaust system and small neighborhood, so she knows I'm home, and she comes out like two or three times looking at me, you know, putting her hands in there like, what are you doing? So I just give her the signal like, I'm busy, honey. I'm talking about business. So, yeah, but it's easy to talk to people, but sometimes when I'm trying to follow a certain protocol or guideline I've set, sometimes I get a little bit too hung up in that to try to get X amount of questions in. So anyway, it's a work in progress, but I'm happy to be here on the show.
Man, I've been listening to your podcast. You're great on it. I mean, I think you and I, in a weird way, are very similar. Obviously, we have similar bodies. I'm huge like you. No. I'm a man's man like you. No. But comedian, professional wrestler now, actor, a television host. But in the world of wrestling, I mean, we were talking about this a little bit yesterday off air. Like, what is there a parallel to kind of what, you know, comedians do? I mean, obviously you're performing for massive audiences compared to what I do, but is there a similarity to sort of what we do and what you guys do?
Man, there totally is, because, you know, once you get in that ring, you know, you're in a 20 by 20 squared circle, as we would call it. And you do something. You have a bad guy and a good guy, a heel and a baby face.
Yeah.
And you do something to elicit a response.
Yeah.
Based on a response you get by that crowd, you know, through your ears and your eyes too, but mainly your ears, then you proceed accordingly and make all your decisions. Sometimes you'll make a wrong decision and you'll kind of lose that crowd. You've got to get them back. So it's working by the, it's flying by the seat of your pants.
Oh my God, that's exactly right.
If you're not listening, you're not doing it right.
Yeah. Now, so in other words, you'll have a storyline going in, but it's a loose storyline and you can improvise within it?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
So can you give me an example? Because understand, I know some of my questions will be like maybe sound basic to you and to your rabid fan base, but some of my listeners may not be up as up on wrestling. So like I'd like, part of what I want, I'm so excited to have you here, is so that they learn about your world behind the scenes. So you'll have a storyline, and explain like what you can do within that storyline, and maybe an example of a storyline where you played with it or whatever.
Well, let's look at a scenario like this. Mm. Say I was the main event.
Yeah.
I always like to watch all the matches that go on before mine, because I'm thinking, hey man, I'm out there, maybe I'm gonna work a guy's arm, I'm gonna work his neck, his back, or whatever. And I watch, you know, the match. Okay, Sam, I'm going to pick an arm. I'm going to work an arm in my match. That's what I'm thinking.
Yeah.
Everything's going to be based off that. I'm, you know, that's his body part that I'm attacking to allow me to win the match, to weaken him. Well, in the first 8 matches, everybody else worked the arm too.
Oh,
so, hello, wow. I'm going to do something different. I'm going to work his back, his leg, his neck. I'm not going to give him an arm routine.
That is exactly what a comedian does, because I'll watch the first 2 opening acts. And if they're talking a lot about jokes about bottled water, or if they happen to be picking on a certain guy up front who's kind of funny looking and everybody's going, I got to go a different direction. It's the exact same thing.
But sometimes you go in like this, okay, take out all the body parts. You're just going to go in and have a match. And you're thinking, okay, I'm just going to start off slow with this guy, kind of tell a traditional story, locking up, doing a little bit of chain wrestling. You go out there.
When you say tell a traditional story, you mean, in other words, like in the wrestling, like
in the realm of or the world of wrestling, let's just say a traditional menu of items that would happen in the match.
Yeah.
Here would be basically the structure. You go out there, bad guy, good guy. The good guy is going to be the better wrestler. He wrestles to get on top. The heel, that low-down, dirty bastard, is going to have to cheat to get back on top.
Got it.
And then he's going to get his heat. He's going to torture that babyface and beat him up. And then that babyface is going to mount a comeback. And then, you know, the heel is going to fly all over the place while the babyface gets his revenge back. And then they go into a finish. And either that babyface is going to win with his finish or get something quick, catch the heel off guard, or the heel is going to screw the baby face and cheat to win. That's your basic, you know,
right,
layout of a match. Now, there's many, many different levels of complexity and, you know, weaving of storylines and psychology, which can go into that basic format. Mm. But by and large, that's pretty much what a wrestling match is. Mm. So if I just go out there and want to lock up with a guy and tell a scientific story, all of a sudden that crowd just sitting on their ass. They're not making a peep. And so I'm starting to think, okay, they're not ready to see this. They wanted to see Stone Cold just go out there and open up that can of whoop ass. So I might back that guy into a corner, have him cut me off. And then after, you know, a little bit of heat, then I'll just start, you know, going haywire on the guy, tossing him around, going into my dirty book.
Yeah.
You know, because I was the kind of baby face that did a lot of underhanded things just by the nature of who Stone Cold was. So anyway, not to beleaguer that point, but there are so many things.
No, you're not. Please go.
That are similar being in a squared circle with being a stand-up comedy.
Yeah.
A comedian, just like you guys. I mean, sometimes you go out there and maybe your traditional stuff isn't working.
Right.
And you say, hey, man, this is kind of a rowdy bunch. Maybe I need to drop a little bit of dirty stuff on them.
Right. Yeah, you have to. It's, and you act, so you know. And
I try to act.
Now you're good. And you've got, and I want to talk about that in a second, sort of that transition from wrestling into Hollywood. But as an actor, as you know, we're kind of told, just be in the moment. Don't be thinking about anything else except what your character wants, and have a relationship with that other character, which is the exact opposite of what you should do if you're a good wrestler or a good comedian, because one ear has to be on the audience. You have to actually split your mind. And I don't know how you found, in terms of that acting, those acting chops, developing that can be a challenge when you've been trained like you have and I have in our main careers to be actually not focused 100% on the thing in front of you.
Yeah, it's a tough day at the office sometimes. I'm so used to, I'm hard of hearing. I don't hear very well. But once you get me in a ring and I'm relying on that response from the crowd, man, I can hear a mouse fart up in row 100.
Right, exactly.
You know, that's how it is, man, because I hear everything then, because I have to, and I feel it. you know, sometimes I go on set, and I'm also very at home being that stone cold character.
Yeah.
It's a lot of my personality turned up in a competitive environment to 10.
Yeah.
So go to, you know, the scene, the set of a movie,
right.
And I'm, you know, Joe Blow,
right.
And this different character, and he's not Steve Austin, he's not Stone Cold, he's Joe Blow,
right.
And I'm trying to come from his wheelhouse, who he is,
right.
And that's tough enough in and of itself, you know,
right.
When you have your elite premier cats like Daniel Day-Lewis, Tom Hanks, Leo DiCaprio, the people like that who are just insanely talented at doing that, and it's a quiet set. And, you know, I'm a performer,
right.
You know, first and foremost.
Right.
I segued into the acting business. So it's tough. I mean, and with, as you know, with anything, the more times you do it, the more experience that you have, the better you become. And so now I'm looking forward. I'm going to go make a few movies this summer. So now I'm looking forward to applying what I've gained in just in the last year. It's like, dude, are you kidding me? You're making this more complex than it is.
Yeah.
You're in the scene. Just be in that moment. Turn off everything else. This is real.
Yeah.
When I was in a wrestling ring, if I was cutting a promo, if I was working with a guy, it didn't matter. I believed 120% in the world that I was in.
Yeah.
If I can just keep, you know, try to apply that into the world of acting, you know, I'll be a little bit better at it. But with anything, experience is paramount.
You have to do it. I mean, but you've cut a nice career for yourself. We should mention June 5th, Redneck Island, third season premieres on CMT. You're in Grown Ups 2, and you have a great podcast on Podcast One called The Steve Austin Show, which I'm going to do at some point.
Yep. Next time, come back to LA.
Face
to face.
Not over the phone.
No, not
over
the phone.
I got you. High five me on that one, brother, because I'm like, you know, whatever. But like, the other thing that in talking to you, it just dawned on me, you've done as a wrestler that we have to do as comedians, is you have to define your persona. Like, as you move along, you have to, and early on in your career, you know, you were Steve Williams, became Steve Austin, you were the ringmaster, you were the stunner, you eventually became Stone Cold. And I think it was 95, is that fair to say, when you really started to hone that Stone Cold persona? The bad boy that, you know, wouldn't play ball. How did that come about? I know that was a big year for you in terms of also, you know, you were fired by Bischoff when you were injured. Like, talk about that year and how much of that was planned and calculated and how much of that was just life happened and then you reacted to it and you seized the moment.
Life happened, I reacted, and seized the moment.
Really?
You know, I got fired by Eric Bischoff down in WCW.
And that wasn't staged. You didn't see that?
No, hell no, it wasn't staged. Man, I had a wife and a kid, bills to pay, you know, the whole deal, like everybody does. I tore my tricep off.
You're 4 or 5 years into wrestling, out of football player out of junior college, right?
Yeah, junior college, North Texas State,
right.
and locally there in Dallas, and then they started sending me to Tennessee. Then I go to WCW.
Did you think about pro football as a career, possibly?
Well, I mean, you know, when you're playing football, everybody wants to play pro football. But, you know, I was pretty keen to the fact that, you know, once a major school didn't recruit me, that I damn sure probably wasn't going to be playing pro football.
Yeah.
So I was good enough to get a free education. You know, I dropped out of 17 hours to graduate. Parents were pissed off at me about that.
Why'd you drop out?
Man, I got tired of doing research papers. You know, 17 hours to graduate, and all of my school was paid for, by my scholarship, my athletic ability. My mom and dad worked their asses off, but they didn't have money to send me to college.
Yeah.
I was going to be the only kid in the family that was going to graduate from college based on scholarship money. You know, my scholarship ran out. I paid for a semester by myself.
Mm-hmm.
I was working on a freight dock, loading and unloading trucks, my specialty in life, driving a forklift. I can perform surgery with a forklift.
Is that right?
And anyway, it ended up getting to the wrestling business. But when you look at, I'm a huge football fan, whether it's college, NFL, whatever. And not soccer. That ain't football. Not Australian rules. Not rugby. That ain't football. I ain't talking about real American football, mister. But, you know, the
Dallas Cowboy fan, right?
Dallas Cowboys, anybody and everybody. Every team has a player or a coach or a program.
I heard you like Peyton Manning.
That I can identify with. I really dig where Peyton's coming from because just a supreme competitor.
Yeah.
Does his homework off the field. Tony Romo, if you listen to this, do your homework off the field. You've got all the tools. He's inherently accurate, quick release. He's very athletic. He's a winner as a quarterback. Just don't crap the bed at the key moments. And you would stop doing that if you did your homework, a la Peyton Manning, Tom
Brady.
Is that
the issue with Tom? Listen, I'm a Patriots fan, okay?
I love Tom Brady.
Now, the issue, I scratched my head that they signed Romo to the size. I know we're off the beaten path here, but I don't care. They signed Romo to a deal that size because I don't think he's that elite quarterback that gets you there.
He could be, I think. He possesses the physical tools. I don't know if he possesses the mental tools. And that's why he needs to go. And, you know, now he's, what, 6-7 years in the league?
Yeah.
He needs to be going to Peyton Manning's camp every summer, like all these young cats do.
Yeah.
Or the game is totally going to pass him by. But he signed a big deal, $100 million contract, lots of guaranteed money. And he is a good quarterback. If a lot of these teams needed a quarterback, he is a great option. But when you're talking about going deep into the playoffs and winning the Super Bowl, it will never happen until he asserts himself as a true leader, takes ownership of that team, puts more weight on his back, and goes into the film room and spends hours, hours, hours.
Well, I was going to ask you, that's what you're talking about when you say do the work off the field.
That's what I mean.
Is there a parallel to wrestling in that sense? Is there stuff that you would do outside the ring in prepping, and not just physically, but whatever it might be?
Man, I watched everything I could get my eyes on.
As a wrestler?
Oh, yeah.
Really? Other wrestlers, you mean?
Yeah. You got to see what everybody else is doing. I mean, like a cat like Shawn Michaels, who was such an innovator, and you know, back in the day when you were jealous of him, you said, oh, he's just a high spot artist, a guy who did a lot of things off the ropes. Hey man, Shawn Michaels is probably the greatest in-ring performer I've ever seen in my life. You watch a cat like that, watch how he operates, watch his in-ring movement, watch his psychology, the way he does things. Watch Bret Hart, watch Ric Flair. Hell, even watch Hogan, who's a limited athletic performer, but he was so over. Study why he's so over. Is it the persona, the charisma, the interview, the whole package? What was it? Yeah. So, man, I studied every single one of these guys. Man, and, you know, I lived it, ate it, breathed it, slept it, everything, because that's who and what I was. And so, yeah, you have to do that. And anything, but let me ask you a question then. You're a stand-up.
Yeah.
You're a former lawyer.
Yeah.
You've got to watch other performers and they're doing, seeing, okay, why do people think this guy's funny?
Oh, yeah, it's the same. I had no idea. This is why I love doing, having these conversations. The parallel between your world of wrestling and comedy is bizarre to me that it's so close because it's exactly the same thing. So I'll watch, I know a lot of my friends who are comedians, obviously, and I'll watch them and people I don't know. To kind of see, like, oh, what's their persona? What's their point of view? How are they pulling that off? How is he getting away with a joke that's that edgy? His likability, maybe. He smiles the right way. Got a nice look to him. Or somebody who just doesn't come across well. Why isn't that person? Why don't I like that person?
What about
all
this
of those
guy?
Things.
What about this guy? The guy who tells a joke that's not that funny when you look at just the technical merit of it. But when he says it, it's funny as hell.
Right.
Whereas you take a guy, you know, and I go back to Hogan, and I'm not disrespecting him because I have a ton of respect for the guy.
Yeah.
But, you know, he drops the leg on a guy's throat, you know, sits down on his ass, or some guy would hit the ropes and he'd just stick his, we call it the big boot, and the guy running to the boot to do something so limited, but to make it so effective and work for him. And, you know, and on another front, you know, like the stages that I went through as when I started wrestling, I broke into Steve Williams. Went to Tennessee, Dutch Mantel named me Steve Austin because there was already another guy named Steve Williams in the business. And then
where did Austin come from?
I was born in Austin, Texas.
Oh, okay.
But I grew up down in Victoria. Mm. So I went out when I went into Tennessee, Dutch Mantel was the booker and also a wrestler. I came in, you know, the owner really didn't even tell him that I was gonna show up. I get in the dressing room, I introduce myself to him, Steve Williams, and he goes, well, you can't be that here. And I said, well, why not? He goes, because you just can't. Because there's already a guy named Dr. Death, Steve Williams. And if you just see the name on a card, you're going to show up maybe thinking you're going to see Dr. Death, and it's my dumb ass, on Green Street.
Right.
So then he says, okay, you know, you got 15 minutes to come up with a name. I couldn't come up with anything. Okay, you got 5 minutes to come up with a name. I couldn't come up with anything. The show's about to start. Jesus. We're in Mid-South Coliseum in Memphis, Tennessee. He says, all right, you're Steve Austin. So that's how I got that.
Wow.
And then he came up with the stunning Steve Austin when I turned heel, and it all turned to end up being Stone Cold. But my progression was a guy in long tights with long blonde hair, clean-shaven face, an okay-looking guy. And that would evolve into the black trunks, the leg braces, because the knee injuries, the bald head, the goatee, and this total ass kicker. So I morphed through my stages until I ended up with the winning thing. And when I think about that, I think of a guy like Larry the Cable Guy,
right,
who when he first started out, I think he originally is from Florida, but he can talk, you know, less redneck than I sound right now.
Oh,
he talks straight up regular English. Well, that's, you know, he was funny as that.
Right.
But when he put that twang in there, and then he turned it into Larry the Cable Guy and endorsed that whole thing.
Flannel shirt with a cutoff.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Then he had the gimmick.
He
had the full package. So, you know, there's just a lot of parallels.
But now, how did you know? See, this is what's so fascinating to me is that you're, you know, just savvy enough to know as you're going along, okay, I'm Steve Williams, a stunner, blah, blah. When you're making those changes from the guy in the long tights with the blonde hair and then you become who you are you consciously saying, okay, all right, I've done this for 6 months, now I need to make another turn, or did it just evolve sort of organically? Like, how did those changes happen, and how did you know when you were pushing the right buttons and hitting on the right thing?
I had a very aggressive style. I took very hard physical bumps. You couldn't see through my work. You thought it was real. Now, you know, this is back, you know, kind of still before all the big time exposés and wrestling came out of the closet, so to speak, and said, hey, we're sports entertainment. We're not real.
Right.
But, you know, I was a very good mechanic in the ring, and I was in WCW, and I was working with one of the greatest pro wrestlers of all time, Ricky the Dragon Steamboat, who had been on top. And from day one, everybody recognized Ricky Steamboat as being one of the premier workers ever to grace the inside of a ring. And so I was working with Ricky, and I said, hey, you know, Ricky, you know, because all the guys respected me because I could work, but the promotion didn't consider me a star, and I wasn't. I was just a guy. And so I would ask Ricky, I said, man, Ricky, you've been there. I said, well, what do I need to do to turn the corner to get higher on the card? Because I was about in the middle of the card, or top half, but not in the main.
Higher on the card, that's a great...
Higher
that's
on the card.
Exactly.
Dude, you know
what
the deal, but you want to be the highest on the card.
Yeah.
And I don't care whether you're a comedian, or whether you're a wrestler, or if you're flipping burgers at McDonald's, you want to be the best burger flipper in that thing.
You
know?
I'm writing that down, higher on the card.
And Ricky said, man, he goes, I don't know, I don't think you're doing anything wrong, Steve. I don't think you need to change anything. Well, you know, it turns out, we almost now end up back where we were a while ago. Got fired by Bischoff.
Yeah.
Remember we were on this note?
Yeah.
And I go to ECW, Extreme Championship Wrestling. Yeah. Paul Heyman calls me on the phone, offers me a job. My tricep is still healing up and says, man, come to ECW and work once a week. And I said, hell, Paul, I said, I can't work. My arm's still busted. He said, you can't. He goes, you don't have to work. Just cut promos. And so I flew to Philadelphia, and my first night there, you know, all kinds of crazy stuff is going on in the ring. Terry Funk and Mick Foley are going at it. Mick Foley swings a flaming chair at Terry Funk. The flame jumps off the chair, lands on a guy in the front row, catches a guy on fire in the front row. I'm in the back thinking, holy smokes, I just got a job, and the job's going to be over. But Paul Lee helped me harness all of the energy.
Was that stage, or was that like truly
not
like
a fire? It was a planned part of the match.
No, but the guy in the front. Oh my god!
Yeah, like they're polling people as they come in. Okay, we're doing a gig here. We need someone to volunteer to catch on fire. There was a little bit of a lawsuit. I don't even know what ever come up. I think the guy ended up getting lifetime tickets to ECW. and that's my kind of lawsuit. No money, tickets for the rest of your
Anytime
life.
Anytime you want to get lit on fire, come on back.
Yeah, come on back, baby. But, you know, Paul Lee helped me harness that energy. And then, you know, that's when Vince called, and he pitched me the Ringmaster idea. And I knew the Ringmaster was a suck-ass gimmick, but it was it's WWE now. It used to be WWF, is the major leagues.
But that's where
you want to go.
But don't you think you popped big and really jumped up a lot when you did that Monday NyQuil skit of it, you know, which was way to get at the Monday Night. Right? Yeah. Tell people about what that was.
Well, I mean, it was just, you know, after I got fired, you know, I had a lot of had a bad taste in my mouth, Mister. Because I mean, really, I always worked hard.
Yeah.
And
by the way, let me just ask this before you answer that. They fired you, and this is another thing that happens to performers and not just comedians. Singers, dancers, anybody that puts yourself out there where you're the product. Somebody's always making judgments. He ain't got it. He can't be highest on the card. He can't be the guy someday. And there's some conversation that maybe Bischoff made that determination about you. This was a chance to get rid of you because you were injured, theoretically, but it was like he didn't believe in you. And I know how that hurts, right? And that had to hurt, right? But also, it gets me mad when that happens. I'm like, all right, I'm going to fucking show you that I can do it.
Dude, I was mad as a hornet. I mean, you know, I work my ass off in that ring.
Yeah.
I make all my shots.
Yeah.
I ain't going to give you no excuses. If I'm supposed to be there, I will be there, barring a serious injury.
Right.
And so, you know, I got fired over the phone, and I can understand now why he didn't believe in me, because sometimes when I look back at my stuff, I don't know how you are about your stuff. When I look back, I sit there. On one hand, I see a good mechanic. On the other hand, I don't see the upside. You know, I was just looking at the stopping point of where I was at that time with my horrible trunks, my stringy long blonde hair. Well, I shaved my head because I was going bald. And so, yeah, I don't blame Bischoff for doing what he did. But was I mad because he didn't think I could be the guy? Yeah.
Yeah.
Because if you don't believe in yourself in anything you do, what are you doing?
The rest of the world.
Because if you can't believe in yourself,
exactly,
why should anybody else exactly believe in you?
Exactly.
And so that hurt, and it made me mad. And when I went to ECW, most of those promos, well, all of them were my idea. I'd call Paul and say, hey, I got an idea. I want to do this. And so we would do it. But that first time, that first night there, after the fire in the front row, when I went back to the Holiday Inn that night and all the guys are cutting their promos, and this was a little ramshackle organization, and they had just very intriguing, off, you know, out-of-the-box characters. I mean, they were breaking such all kinds of ground, and some of the best promos in the business were coming out of ECW at the time. And finally, it got close to being my time. It was about 4:30 in the morning. And Paulie says, all right, because I was last on the car, last on the thing, because everybody else is already entrenched in storylines. They're the priority.
Right.
I'm the new guy. I got to earn my stripe. And so Paulie says, okay, Steve, we're ready for you. And I go over there, and I'm a little bit sheepish because I've got a little bit of microphone time in WCW, but not a whole lot. And I said, well, hell, Paul, man, I'm a sailboat in the water. And I ain't even got my sail up, and there's not no wind blowing. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I'm just floating out there. I ain't got nothing.
Yeah.
And Paulie, I said, what do you want me to talk about? And he says, hell, Steve, just talk about how you're feeling. You just got fired. He goes, just let it all out.
Yeah.
And I talked for 7 minutes, and that was one of the greatest promos I ever cut in my life. And I came from my heart, my guts, how I was feeling. Put it all on the line.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was shooting with it. And as we say in the business, it was a real deal.
Yeah.
And so anyway, I hold no animosity towards Bischoff or anything like that. Getting fired was the greatest thing that ever happened to me. But Paul Lee helped me harness all that energy and my competitive drive as an athlete and a performer, and just focus all of that into one promo. And the other stuff that was like, I remember Kevin Nash was one of the guys who lobbied for me in WWE or WWF. He said, hey, man, he goes, what are you guys doing with Austin? You know, he's one of the hottest properties as far as being a free agent down here in ECW. You guys aren't going to do nothing with him?
Mm.
I think he was one of the guys that got Vince to take another look at me.
Right.
And that's when he called and offered me the ringmaster job. And when he offered me the ringmaster job, it was all about me feeding my family and paying the bills.
Yeah.
That lasted for 6 months. And to your timeline question, after 6 months of that, you know, you don't ever just make a decision based on time.
Yeah.
But at that time, I'd already been in the business 7.5 years. So I knew that this gimmick was going nowhere. I knew that you were never going to see the ringmaster on the top of Madison Square Garden.
Why? How did you
know? Come in the ringmaster. Yeah. Come on, man.
Yeah.
Which one sounds better? Ringmaster versus The Rock, or Stone Cold Steve Austin versus The Rock? You know what I'm saying?
It is about marketing.
And like, what kind of persona does this ringmaster have? And does this, if he does end up having a persona, does that name really capture it?
Yeah.
When you put Stone Cold in front of Steve Austin, hey, man, all you got to do is see that cat one time.
Yeah.
And you're hooked, and you understand where he's coming from. And it was almost like an everyman type of gimmick where it was just me against the system, me being pissed off about trying to be held down and just breaking through all that.
That's where that's why you say that firing was the best thing that ever happened, because it brought to the surface these feelings and it created a persona, in the i.e. the Stone Cold persona, that that broke you through.
Yeah, because I would have never had that persona. Because I didn't get screwed over.
It created a defiant personality.
I had to. It was shit or get off the pot.
And tell people this promo that we keep talking about, who may not be familiar with, check it out online. But you basically, you were mocking Monday Night Nitro, but with a thing Monday NyQuil.
Yeah, that one was just, a Monday NyQuil, and their show putting people to sleep. And now I kind of did the Bischoff impersonation, was kind of mimicking or saying some of the same things that he had been saying. When I look back these days, I mean, it wasn't that great, but it was entertaining back then.
But it wasn't, but the thing that you always had that most wrestlers didn't have was you had comedic timing and a comedic sensibility. Like, you had sort of, and I don't know if you had comedic interests, like if you watched comedians, you had any comedic influences, but you had a little something special. I remember watching you as a fan that most of the wrestlers didn't have. Where did that come from? Did that was just natural stuff coming out of you? Or did you sort of hone that as well?
No, man, I'm a big fan of comedy, but my whole family, my mom and dad are still around. My dad, I think, just turned 77. My mom just had her 70th birthday last week. Mm. And I got three brothers and a sister. There's seven of us all together. When we get together, I mean, as you go through life, and you're middle class. I mean, you better laugh at a bunch of stuff, or you're gonna be really mad about a lot of stuff. Yeah. And you laugh at the things that, all your hardships that you have to work through. And then when you get through them, you use humor to just let it all out and go with the flow and just go through life.
Right.
And sometimes you gotta lower your head and buffalo through things. Sometimes you just gotta stand back and laugh. Every time, our family gets together, and thank God we're all still here, it's just one big, it's a bunch of stand-up comedians hanging around each other. None of us have any technical training. We're not stand-up comedians.
No, but
that is such a tough racket. It's unbelievable. But humor and comedy was just a big part of my family life and growing up. And I just grew up being a fan of, Richard Pryor. Eddie Murphy had a great run. Dice Clay, George Carlin. Talked to you the other day about Mitch Hedberg.
That surprised me. He says to me on the phone, he goes, I just, this cat I've been listening to recently, I just got turned on to Mitch Hedberg, who unfortunately passed away. And I didn't think that you would connect with somebody like Mitch Hedberg, because he's, Mitch is a very acquired taste and whatever. And I was really struck by that. It was pretty cool.
Oh, the guy was, it was awesome. But you got to think about it like this. Okay, you're in a car, you're going down the road, times are tough, you don't have any money. So in that car are about four or five or six other wrestlers traveling down the road. Half the time you're starving. You got to stay at a shitbox motel because you can't afford a good one. There's three or four guys deep in a room.
Yeah.
Low guy on a totem pole is sleeping on the floor or on the cot that they bring in for you.
This is your life early on.
Oh, yeah. So, man, when you're going down the road, if you're not talking about, the business, talking about psychology, or talking about what this guy was doing or how that match went, what if I'd have done this?
Yeah.
You're just reliving everything that happened. But along the way, you can't always just talk about the business. Most time you can, but then it just turns into, what do guys do when they're hanging around?
Exactly.
You start laughing and cracking on each other because that's what you do.
Exactly.
Okay, so check it out. Let me ask you a question.
Yeah.
You're riding down the road with a couple of comedians.
What
are you guys talking about?
We talk about the show and how it went. It's unbelievable. Like, if we had any physical ability, we could be wrestlers. But it's just, if we weren't scrawny little, pot-smoking weasels, we could do what you guys did. Same thing. We talk about the shows, talk about whatever, help maybe, I'm stuck on this joke, whatever, and I would imagine you guys would help each other creatively, like I'm playing with this thing. And then we, talk about what we saw on HBO, or just start cracking on each other. Like, around and, it's like a roast in the car, and you
does it ever turn into a competition, though, because this is what you guys do?
Oh, sometimes, trying to top each other. What comedians won't do is, I'll insult you, right? And you won't laugh at it. You'll just come back with yourself. Never laugh at
it. You can't put it over.
And this one guy, buddy of mine named Rich Voss, he's a funny guy, and he loves to bust chops. And like he'll never when you could have the best one on him, like you could get him great, like in all the other comedians at the table will be laughing, and he won't laugh, and he'll come back with another one. And I go, you have to laugh at that. You have to. That's a really good one. And then he'll start to laugh. But it's the same thing. It's the same thing. So life on the road. You're single, great-looking guys. You're in front of... are women just... What's that like? I mean, I know you're married now. I don't want to get you in trouble. But, like, because as a comedian, and I got no game at all, but, like, there is that thing where you're on stage, you're doing well, people got a couple of drinks in them, you're at... Later, people start chit-chatting with you. You're in that town, that star for that moment. And it could lead to things like what is that life like, as whether starting out or you're at the mountaintop and you're stone cold.
Well, it's interesting when you're starting out, and then all of a sudden you come from, I always call it, you know, my days before wrestling and my days after wrestling. That's my civilian life. You know, when I got out of the business, I turned back into a civilian.
Yeah, it's funny. That's what we call ourselves.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So, anyway, getting back, starting out on the road, man, I'm hanging out with guys who've been in the business 10, 15 years, and we make our first stop, and all of a sudden, man, these, you know, women show up that are following the wrestling show from town to town, or, you know, different towns have the different ones. I'm like, man, what in the hell is going on? Because I was always in a, you know, relationship with my girlfriend or whatever. So this is totally new to me.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it wasn't like I had a tremendous game either. I just kind of always did my deal and did good, It wasn't like I was having to go out there and be, you know, Laurence Olivier dropping some smooth, you know, rap on somebody. But, you know, get on the road and all that stuff happens. And then, man, the higher up you are on that card, you know, that's kind of, the territory kind of, the stakes increase and all the other stuff.
Quality
gets better. And then, you know, you have, you know, life on the road stuff. You know, that's one of the fun elements of being on the road, but also one of the elements which leads to so many divorces and so many problems in so many of the guys' lives. And I have experience in that as well. But then, you know, also with that, being that guy, I always look at it like this. You're living almost three lives in one body. On one hand, you're a rock star. Because, man, you get in town, everybody wants to hang and do things with you.
Right.
On the other hand, you're a professional athlete. You're training your ass off. You're getting the hell beat out of you in that ring every damn night. You got to take care of yourself, but it's full speed ahead. On the other end of that, you're a truck driver. You got to get yourself to and from all these shows. And all this is in one body. And then, you know, time on the road. Let me ask you about this one. Time on the road, you're away from your family. I'm a loner. I love being alone, but I love people. I love being around them.
Yeah.
So, but when you get out on the road, I don't know if the word lonely is the right word, but it's just, it sure does lead one easily to alcohol.
Yeah.
And the other things that go on the road. I remember, you know, before I ever got in the wrestling business, I have never seen a pain pill.
Mm.
I'm riding down the road with somebody and they say, hey, man, you want a Vike? I said, a what? They said, a Vicodin. I said, well, what's that? It's a pain pill. I said, what's it do? Well, give you a buzz. Well, okay, I'll take one. Mm-hmm. And I was never a big pain pill guy. Certainly took mine when I had my injuries. But then, you know, when you use them, just to get a buzz off a couple of cups of coffee and a Vicodin, that's not a good thing. But one thing leads to another, and everything keeps escalating. So the road can be a dangerous place.
But you never had any serious issues with any of that stuff?
Oh, no. I never had any issues with that, man. I was smart enough, and you know, the way my parents raised me.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't want to say I'm smarter than anybody else because I have a lot of my buddies that are no longer here that are probably smarter than me, but they stayed at the party too long or party too hard and things just didn't work out. And I just hate that so many of the guys have gone, you know, down that way.
Yeah.
But man, for me, you know, the things on the road could only reach, okay, if barely using is one,
right,
and using a lot is 10,
yeah,
I was on that guy who stayed about the 3 to 5 range on that that's end kinda, of it. Now, on the drinking part of it, I was a 9 or 10. Yeah, that was my deal.
Yeah, you and I are a lot alike. Yeah. I'm on the lower end of the range of the other stuff, and then I'll stay at the party and drink and whatever. And I know what you mean. You said is the word lonely, maybe disconnected.
Yeah.
That for me, like, you know, now the road for me usually is, I'll go out, you know, a week or two at a time, sometimes half a week. I don't know, you're on the road in that era, at that point, are you on the road for weeks at a time, months at a time?
Yeah, that was weeks and sometimes leading to a month. Now, the guys a few years ahead of me, you know, when Kevin Nash first came to WWF, you know, I think he was on the road 300 days a year. So I was.
Well, at that point, they're doing like a bus, right, and stuff like that.
No, man, that was predominantly all car and airplane. You fly to a spot, and you know you're gonna get your rental car, drive a loop, you know, return rental car, or you're gonna get a drop car at a different airport and drop. Now, once you go over to the European market or anywhere that's not United States, other than Canada, that's when you bust out your tour buses.
How come you guys don't bust out a tour bus? Why wouldn't they bust out tour buses here? That's so much easier.
Hey, man, it was all about economics. And, you know, like these days, a lot of the guys lease tour buses. The top guys are leasing tour buses in the States. They have their driver. They get done with the show. They get in their tour bus, and they're chilling in their own place.
Sleep.
They got their own bed. They sleep. And it's a way to really preserve yourself from a health standpoint. But this was back before that. I wish I'd have been the one that came up with the tour bus idea, but my cheap ass, I was known, me and Mick Foley used to travel together. Everybody who traveled me knew I knew how to save a buck.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I was probably too cheap to do that.
How was Mick Foley to hang out with? Is he a good guy? Yeah, he's been on the Daily Show once. Seemed like a real nice guy. Like, talk about him for a minute.
Mick Foley is a tremendous cat.
Yeah.
Very, very smart
guy.
Very
gentle guy. Like,
oh, man, yeah. I mean, the most gentle guy who could be probably one of the toughest human beings in the world from the standpoint of absorbing punishment. The things that he's put his body through. The MO to his work style in the ring, or his persona, you know, with barbed wire, thumbtacks, bumps, you know, 25-foot, 30-foot bumps in the tables, chair shots, barbed wire, fire, anything, you name it, Mick's done it. But as a human being, anytime I came to work, which was anywhere in the world, and there was Mick, I'd say, hey, Mick, come here, I got a question to ask you. Because if I had anything that required some deep thinking, I always asked Mick.
Is that right?
And as my travel partner, one of my travel partners, he'd stay at a shit box with me. I never would let him drive because he's a horrible wheel man. And if he's listening to this, he knows he's a horrible
wheel man. Well, why is he horrible? He just doesn't pay
not a great driver. Not a great driver. Diamond Dallas Page, another one of my good friends and travel partners, horrible driver. Kevin Nash is one of the guys I let drive. Billy Gunn, another
great
wheel man.
What are these guys doing? Are they hitting things or just not paying attention?
Just absent-minded. I mean, you know, kind of veering off another lane or missing a turn. And, you know, I it's like my old buddy Ravishing Rick Rude used to say, he goes, arrive alive, Steve. If I was hauling ass down the road, and that, I always took pride in my safety skills as a driver.
Right.
But to Rick's point, arrive alive.
Yeah.
We always did.
So how do you talk about your workout regimen? I mean, you're still in amazing shape, but obviously you probably were working out even more when you were, you know, wrestling full time. But talk about that. And the second part of this is, you cannot really, because you were talking about 25-foot drops and whatever, you can't really train to fall and land on a mat 25 feet. I did a piece for The Daily Show years ago where we went to a pro wrestling school in Atlanta, and they showed me some moves, and we did this piece. You could be the greatest physical human specimen on the face of the planet. How do you, so at some point, if you just accepted to yourself as a wrestler, I'm going to be injured X number of times this year because there's nothing I can do to practice falling where I don't get hurt. How do you do that?
Let's look at the first part of that question just as far as the training.
Yeah.
You know, the training, people always ask me, how'd you guys stay in shape on the road? Well, let's just stay specifically in the United States. Mm. And it was like this anywhere else in the world. You have been to most of those places already, or guys before you have been there. They will tell you where the gym is. As soon as you land, you get your rental car. You go to the gym, score a tan, go grab something to eat, go to the building, either drive to the next town or go back to the hotel, sleep, maybe hit that same gym, drive to the next destination. The United States is one big loop.
To be disciplined, yeah.
You have to be disciplined, but everybody knows where the gym is.
Right.
And mister, in today's day and age, and even when I was in the ring, you had to be in shape.
And what was your, were you working out every other day, 3 hours a day? Like what?
No, you don't have time to do that. You're working out about 5 to 6 days a week. Just hitting all your, you know, maybe a body part, you know, once or twice a week. Mm-hmm. There's nothing scientific about that. It was just staying in shape and frequency. And along with the fact that you're in the ring, and once you get in that ring, I would do, you know, about 30 minutes of cardio while I was at the gym as well. But that cardio in the ring is so intense because you're performing in front of that many thousands of people. Mm-hmm. And being in shape on a treadmill is different than jumping to an octagon and fighting a human being, or jumping in a 20x20 wrestling ring and wrestling a guy full bore and putting on a show.
Right.
So it's such an intense workout just being in the ring. Mm-hmm. So that's pretty much covers the physicality of the condition you're in. Now, when I was on the road and being a little bit heavy on the drinking side, sometimes, you know, I wasn't the most sound guy when it came to nutrition. Mm-hmm. I could have treated myself a little bit better then, but then again, The work in the ring was so intense. My weight workouts were pretty hardcore. You know, I stayed in good shape. Mm-hmm. And plus, I was a lot younger guy back then.
Yeah.
Anything's easy when, you know, you've got age on your side.
Right.
Now, let's talk about the bump aspect of that. Mick Foley, how do you train for a 25-foot bump off a steel cage on top of an announcer's desk? You don't. You look at it. Or you have this idea in your head, you think you want to take this bump because it's the biggest pay-per-view of the year, and you want to go out there and put it all on the line, and you decide that that's what you're going to do. Because that's, at least you are trained in learning how to take a bump, learning how to fall. If I left this room right now and tumbled down the stairs, I know how to fall. Whereas if the guy walking behind me tumbled down those stairs, he'd break an arm, maybe a leg or something like that.
Right.
We know how to fall.
Yeah.
But you don't know how to fall for 25 feet, but you know you're going to have to time that thing so that you're going to be, you know, on your back once you hit that desk. And it's a calculated risk at best.
But then how do you even, are you practicing that with like nets somewhere?
No, you can't. Now I won't say that no one.
You guys are insane. Like I would look and go, I can't do this. Like, what can I?
Well, I won't say that no one has ever practiced a gag before a Monday Night Raw. Because sometimes when they've come off that scaffolding back in the day, I think Shane McMahon would do a test onto a crash pad before they removed that and used whatever they used, not in the form of a crash pad. But as far as Mick Foley going, that night or several times doing what he did, hey, you take a look at it, you talk to the guy about it, and this is how it's going to be done. Here's one time. I was in Memphis, Tennessee. We were wrestling a pay-per-view. It was St. Valentine's Day Massacre, and I was wrestling Vince McMahon. Vince McMahon had a big idea that we were going to climb onto the top of that cage, and I was going to do something to him so he flew off and land on the announce tables. Well, man, at the time, Vince is probably 58 or 60, you know, thereabouts.
Yeah.
Maybe it's 55 or 57. This is going back about 10 years. And Vince ain't never took a bump like that. But because it's a pay-per-view, this guy wants to put it all on the line, and because of who I was in this feud, because Stone Cold hated McMahon and McMahon hated Stone Cold, and he wanted to take this bump just to make that match that much better. And I remember we were up on the side of that cage, and you know, he's the one that wanted to take the bump. I said, "Here we go." I crashed his head into the steel cage, and he sprang off. And he almost made a good landing, but he caught it about halfway. He should have caught it more to the center of the desk on a sweet spot,
right.
But he caught the edge in the lip. I saw his head whip down, classic whiplash, and then he fell over like a pile of trash. And I'm up there on top. I'm 15 feet in the air thinking, Jesus Christ, we got about 10 more minutes of this match left. I don't know what I'm going to do with this son of a bitch because he can't work. We did the whole deal. They put him on a stretcher, and I tipped the stretcher over and get his ass back in the ring, and we finished the match.
Really?
But, you know, Vince McMahon would never do anything or ask you to do anything that he won't do himself.
Right.
But that's as a performer, and, you know, sometimes you got to go on a limb as a stand-up and just totally be brave enough to take a stance on a situation or an issue at hand, or just to present some fresh material, and it's either going to work or it ain't. Obviously, when you're taking a 15 to 25, 30-foot bump and it don't work, that's not good.
All right, so that was part one of my interview with Stone Cold Steve Austin. I really loved this conversation with him, and part two as well, because it goes in a lot of different directions that I didn't expect. I love the conversation about, in this first part, about how he gets fired by Bischoff, and that ends up being the best thing that ever happened to him, and how he makes a seven-minute promo that really changes things, and how Nash helped him and Lee. It's just really, really interesting stuff. And the second part, really cool too. A lot of great conversation there about his life and how he built his career and everything. And check me out this coming weekend, October 28, 29, 30, Friday, Saturday, Sunday at the West Palm Beach Improv, West Palm Beach, Florida. Again, October 28, 29, 30, Friday through Sunday, West Palm Beach Improv. Go to palmbeachimprov.com for tickets. Thanks for checking out the podcast, everybody.